This is Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Janaea Williams. Maybe you've seen the protests that erupt sometimes outside of a new coffee shop or upscale restaurant in a transitional neighborhood. Activists say they've noticed a pattern. When a restaurant offering, say, $30 entrees opens in a working-class neighborhood, rents start to rise faster, there are more evictions, and longtime locals are forced to leave. Don't think the owners of those new restaurants are unaware. In fact, some of them are now trying hard to limit their impact on gentrification. But is it enough, or will their presence always be problematic? KCRW's Megan Jamerson takes the story from here.
Here's how Leonardo Vilches describes the pattern in Boyle Heights.
When gentrification happens, the prices start going up. So it's not affordable for the businesses to stay there, but it is affordable for these new businesses to come in. So little by little, they start replacing the market. And then that changes people's access to food and to the things that they used to have. So things become more expensive.
Vilches is a community organizer in Boyle Heights and co-founder of the local tenants union. He points out that some fancier places try to look like the community, even if long-timers don't actually go there.
This aesthetic is a cartoon of the locality that is trying to appeal to the white, more affluent customer. And I would push that it's not just about whiteness, it's class.
And you know it's about class when you see the menu prices. It might be a $5 donut or $18 burger. These are prices that are out of reach for low-income families, regardless of race. Combine that with an aesthetic that looks wealthy, and suddenly the neighborhood can feel like it's no longer for them.
So if you have a high-class or a very brand-new, painted, very colorful business right next to the small insurance company or the little bike store, it sends a message, oh, we don't belong here anymore. And that's the problem with that, too. It's not that this business doesn't belong here anymore. It doesn't belong here. It's that the others feel the push. The others feel that, okay, this is a threat for me. Now my rent is going to go up. Now I'm going to have to figure out what am I going to do.
You could see all this play out in June in Glassell Park, a small working-class Latino neighborhood in northeast L.A. John Urquiza was one of around two dozen protesters who showed up when a restaurant called Dunsmore opened up. He says a restaurant with $40 entrees isn't culturally relevant to Glassell Park's residents.
That's the surface. What really it is about is the economics. You're talking about a class of people who have way more income, way more assets, and way more resources into a neighborhood that to them is an opportunity. It's a value for them.
Urquiza says real estate that's a value for outsiders is just one or two rent hikes away from eviction for locals. He's a photojournalist, and he experienced this firsthand when he lost his photography studio in Highland Park because of rising rents. In Glassell Park, the restaurant Dunsmore offered their employees a living wage, and after the protests, they hosted a community dinner. Urquiza is very skeptical that these gestures of goodwill make a difference.
How do you balance the displacement you create versus the exploitation you're having on the community or the exploitation you're doing on the community?
The building where the restaurant is located is quickly filling up with new tenants. Urquiza says they didn't protest any of the others because the police started patrolling the area. One of those businesses is a bustling breakfast and sandwich spot modeled after an old school diner. It's called Bub and Grandma's, and the owner is Andy Caden. He lives 5 minutes away in Highland Park, where he saw entrepreneurs do
lots of dumb things, lots of good things, lots of completely unaware things.
He considered opening in Highland Park, but he was worried the tensions over gentrification there would overshadow his intention to be a community spot. So when the opportunity came along to open in Glassell Park, his team jumped on it.
I don't want to take advantage of anyone in order for this business to be successful.
One of the first decisions his team made was to keep the menu affordable. He says sandwiches are around $12 because that's what people were already paying in the neighborhood. Also, locals get a 5% discount when they show the cashier a blue metal keychain that has the words Bub's Local etched into it.
It looks like a little trapezoidal metal dog ID tag.
He's given out 500 so far. They also give bread to the mutual aid fridge across the street and to other nonprofits. Things Caden says are simply about being a good neighbor.
It wasn't like we weren't going to engage with them anyway, but now it's like all the more imperative that everyone who lives here already knows that we're thinking of them.
These questions are things that every entrepreneur should be asking themselves before they open, says Chef Jenny Dorsey.
I think it's very hard to build trust if trust hadn't been established at the beginning or if that wasn't a priority.
She coaches hospitality businesses in New York City and Los Angeles to take active steps to use their business as a force for community building and fighting displacement.
It's not often not some sort of like intentional thing that people are trying to do some harm. However, as a result of perhaps not intentionally thinking about community investment, it becomes a complicit vehicle for gentrification.
But there are limits to good intentions. You can even be from the community, and you still have to be pretty careful about not causing displacement. Barney Santos is acutely aware of this.
It's tough. It's really tough.
Santos and his wife started a consulting business to bring economic development to Montebello. His wife grew up in this historically working-class Latino city. He grew up nearby in Downey. Together, they bought some property in Montebello. They decided to start with community input before coming up with a plan for what to do with it.
We're like, hey, we're going to have a town hall. We're going to bring pizza. We're going to have like 20 people and we have a discussion.
They did that several times and talked to over 200 people of different ages. The biggest takeaway was that millennials like him wanted a community gathering place centered around food.
A lot of people my age and younger were getting degrees at high rates. We're becoming upwardly mobile. Our palates are changing because we're traveling more. We're watching like Anthony Bourdain shows and all these things. And you know, we're looking at our communities and thinking like, well, there's not a lot of that stuff where we live.
So they created Boulevard Market. It's a food hall and incubator space for local entrepreneurs. Santos has gotten mostly positive feedback from locals who he says love the space. But he's starting to see other changes to the neighborhood.
I've seen outside community members who now have bought houses here who don't look like community members that exist here. And they approached me really excitedly saying, thank you so much. We moved here because of you.
He says he's happy to engage with people like that because it's exciting.
At the same time, at the back of my mind, I can't help but think like, what did we do? Did we open the gates also? As intentional and as responsible as we are we also contributing?
And those questions, say Santos, sit heavy with him. Restaurants can stand fully with a community, but it will take more than that to stop gentrification, says Jenny Dorsey.
Hospitality business owners are not going to fix gentrification. Like, it would be great if they could, you know, but that's just not how it works. Gentrification is decades in the making, and it's not going to be unraveled overnight.
Instead, she says restaurant owners could do a lot to create systemic change. If they hire locally, one place to start is working with the local tenants union. There, business owners can help keep the workers they employ in the neighborhood. For KCRW, I'm Megan Jamerson.
Coming up, a life sentence for stealing $14 in change. That story after this break on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back now with Greater LA, California's three strikes law is still in effect, but since 2012, non-serious and non-violent felonies have stopped counting as third strikes, and thousands of people have been released. but not Dawood Colson, at least not until recently. 20 years ago, Dawood was sentenced to life in prison with a chance for parole after 35 years. His crime was walking into an open garage and stealing $14 in change. For that, he was found guilty of robbery and burglary, which amounted to his third and fourth strikes. He remained behind bars because his crimes were categorized as low-level violent offenses, even though they involved no physical harm. A judge recently released Dawood, but many others in his situation are still locked up. Sam Levin is a reporter for The Guardian, and he profiled Dawood Colson's case. He joins me now, and Dawood Colson is here with us as well. Hi to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Thanks so much for having us.
So, Dawood, I want to start with you, and I want to start by saying that I'm really happy you're here with us on the outside after everything you've been through. So how are you doing since your release?
I'm good. It's taking some adjusting, but life is good. I'm good. You know, I have a big network, you know, that's helping me out here. You know, everybody seems to be on the positive side. So everything's going well so far.
That's good to hear. Sam, since California adopted the three strikes law in 1994, there's been a huge increase in the state's prison population. Since then, there have been reforms to the law, as I mentioned. So what's the legacy of this law from your perspective? And did it reduce crime?
So research has repeatedly found that there's no evidence that this law reduced crime rates or deterred violence. But what the research has shown is that it dramatically increased the prison population in California. And so today we still have 33,000 people who remain incarcerated under the law. And there's, you know, severe racial disparities with that. Mm-hmm. You know, 45% of people who are serving life sentences due to three strikes are Black, despite Black residents making up just 6.5% of the population in California. Mm-hmm. So the legacy of this is mass incarceration in California and the sort of racial inequalities in our criminal legal system.
Dawood, you were in your mid-30s when you were convicted. You had struggled with substance abuse issues, a rough upbringing, and a doctor diagnosed you as having schizophrenia. And the judge at the time seemed to acknowledge that, and yet you were still given a life sentence. Do you remember what you were thinking back then when that sentence was handed down?
Once again, I was thinking, you know, again, I'm being kicked to the curb, you know, like I told the judge, like I told Judge Lowenthal, you know, for years I've been crying out for help and no one hurt me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you know, I feel that the system failed, you know, the system is failing everybody because I really think that the judicial system can do better just by asking questions, you know, a simple question, you know, what's going on? What made you act this way? You know, if they would just ask that, you know what I mean? I'm sure that they would come to better conclusions than just throwing them away and you know, getting rid of the key. It's, right. it's crazy, you know, how they're just welding the door shuts on these guys, you know? And it's like all the laws that are being passed now, none of them really affect the third strikers. You know, all of them are affecting the second strikers and the first strikers. None of them are really affecting the third strikers, mm-hmm. you know? And those are the guys who's, if you look, you know what I mean? The recidivism rate for a third striker is very, very minute, if any at all, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to the second striker. You know, I think the system is actually built to, you know, continue revolving door. You know, because, I mean, as long as you're letting second strikers out, you know, they have another chance to offend or whatever the case. They're more likely to offend as opposed to a third striker. You know, right. it's just, the system is just broken. It's just broken.
Right. Because others have certainly served much less time or no time for worse offenses yes. than yours, which was walking into an open garage and taking $14 in change. So did that make it hard for you yes. to endure those years you spent in prison?
I wouldn't say hard. You know what I mean? Because this wasn't my first time in prison. Mm-hmm. But to look at it in the perspective that you just put it in, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It kind of made it rough. You know what I mean? Because right. it's like, I know for a fact that, you know, there are other people who committed more heinous crimes than me, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And have been released in a lot less time. I mean, you know, you have dudes who, you know, committed mayhem or murder or whatever the case may be, and they're going home. And it's like, right. wait a minute, man, I don't have a body. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't take a body part or anything like that. It's like, I didn't cut an arm off or anything or, you know, so mm-hmm. I'm like, wow. I can't go home to my family, and you know, but yeah, just like the judge was telling me about this guy that was in Long Beach about the same time I was. He was committing crimes at about the same time I was committing crimes, and he was in the same city that I was in, but his crimes were a lot worse. You know, his crimes was like driving under the influence, assault on a peace officer, mm-hmm. you know, with a weapon and so forth and so on, you know, things like that of that nature, beating his girlfriend up and stuff like that, you know, and but he ended up with 3 years. And the judge told me, and he said, man, you know, the difference between you and this guy. And I'm like, no, I have no clue what the difference is between you and this guy. He's like, well, the difference is, you know, he was white.
So, Sam, I want to ask more about that judge, the judge who released Dawood, Judge Lowenthal. What did he say?
He couldn't comment specifically on his case, but in the courtroom, what he said to Dawood at the resentencing in which he was releasing him was that, you know, essentially this shocks the conscience. You know, this case is so shocking. And he really went through the basic facts of this case and the extremely harsh sentence that Dawood got for, you know, these very, very minor offenses that were related to poverty and related to the struggles that he was going through. And he acknowledged that and basically said that this, you know, person never should have gone to prison for the offenses he had. He you know, if he was sentencing Dawood today, it would be, you know, for parole and putting him into a treatment program to help him with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, back then, he got, you know, 35 years to life, one of the harshest sentences you could receive.
So there are a lot of other inmates in similar situations to Dawood's who are still behind bars. So are their cases also being reevaluated, or does it take a lawyer to pursue this and a judge like Judge Lowenthal to order a release?
Yeah, there are thousands of people like Dawood who remain incarcerated. There are thousands more who are left behind because their cases are classified as serious and violent, even when they are, you know, just like Dawood's case, you know, with mm-hmm. minor offenses related to issues of poverty and other health issues. And so it requires, you know, district attorneys to take on this and review cases and call for resentencing. In the case of Dawood's resentencing, the prison system itself, CDCR, the California Department of Corrections, actually recommended he be resentenced.
Dawood, you're 55 now. You had children from before you were locked up, and now you have grandchildren. Congratulations. You're married, too. And I know it's hard to summarize 20 years, but how did you make mm-hmm. it through your time in prison? And what's readjustment to society been like for you so far, now that you're out?
Truthfully, the way that I made it through prison through those 20 years was through my religion, through my faith, Islam. You know, Islam brought me through. You know, I think without that, I would have broke. Yeah, my wife and my religion was my rock.
Well, what's it been like to spend time with your grandchildren?
Oh man, that was so amazing. You know, it was crazy because the way it transpired was my son had man, I love this dude, man. My son set me up, man. He took me to my grandson's football game. So we go into the stadium, so we're sitting in the bleachers. So my son tells me, he's like, Dad, man, I'm finna go to the car for a minute, man. I'll be back. So I'm like, okay, cool. So he goes to the car. He stays gone. Excuse me.
Hmm.
Oh, man. Yeah, he stays gone for like 5 minutes. And when he comes back, he's got like this entourage of people behind him. And I'm looking. And lo and behold, it's my daughter and all my grandchildren and her husband.
Wow.
And yeah, man.
Amazing.
Yeah, and just like it's hitting me now, it mm-hmm. hit me then, you know. So my daughter was like, oh, you big old crybaby. So I'm in the stands and I'm crying, you know, and she comes up and she hugs me and I'm like, oh man, you guys really set me up good, man.
I've been speaking with Dawood Colson, Long Beach native, recently released from prison after 20 years, and Sam Levin, reporter for The Guardian. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Back now with even more Greater LA. I'm Janaea Williams. Can you hear that? It's the sound of the Gay Freedom Band of Los Angeles. They're a group of volunteer and amateur musicians from all around Greater LA who get together to make beautiful noise. And they'll be performing this weekend. With us to talk about the show is Joseph Vranas, the artistic director of the Gay Freedom Band. Joseph, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. So tell us a little bit about what the Gay Freedom Band is all about. How long have you been around? What kind of folks are in it? What kind of music do you play?
For sure, yeah. So the Gay Freedom Band of Los Angeles has been around for 45 years. We're going to be celebrating our 45th anniversary next year. Started in 1978. It started as a marching band that led the annual Gay Pride Parades. And it was originally founded under the name the Great American Yankee Band
of
Los Angeles.
Yeah. I love that it stands for gay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and through with that acronym kind of hidden right in plain sight, the band was able to participate in other local parades that normally would not have been allowed to participate in. But on the bass drums of the original group, that acronym, the Great American Yankee Band, was pretty obvious. So during the parade, they figured out what the band was all about.
So you're saying it was a way to sneak in being gay in the 70s. And was that because people wouldn't have been so welcoming or?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And there was a little bit of pushback when they would see the gay on the bass drum. There was a few anecdotes about possibly some big brick throwing or some insults thrown towards the band as they played in the parades.
And how did they deal with that?
As far as I know, they just kept marching and just kept playing, you know, as the band plays on, as it were.
The band plays on.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned at the top, this weekend, the band will be performing a special program called Just Cause, Music with a Purpose. So what are some of the causes the program will be addressing?
Sure. So each of the pieces that we are performing have a specific cause associated with them. Pieces relating to civil rights and equality. We have gender equality, plastic pollution, gun violence, and our highlight, kind of pinnacle of the concert, is a piece called Watchmen Tell Us of the Night by a composer named Mark Camphouse. And that piece is highlighting survivors of child abuse. And it's taken from a poem by John Bowring in 1825, set to a church hymn by Elvy, the Come Ye Thankful People Come, which is kind of featured throughout the piece. And because that piece is kind of our highlight, we kind of took the theme of the watchman kind of shining a lantern on things as kind of the theme of the concert. We are shining a light on these different causes. In our program, we highlight different organizations that support these causes, and we'll discuss kind of what the composers are achieving in their music and how these representations are manifesting in the pieces.
I've been talking with Joseph Rannis, Artistic Director at the Gay Freedom Band. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
If you want to catch the Gay Freedom Band this weekend, they'll be playing on Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m. at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church in Midtown. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, more updates on local elections and millennials deciding if they want to bring children into a warming world. That's next week on Greater LA. Check out our website, kcrw.com/GLA. While you're there, share your thoughts with us. And of course, we'd be honored if you subscribe to the podcast too, all at kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Nihar Patel, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Jody Adler, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordal all helped put the show together today. I'm Janaea Williams. Thank you so much for listening.